I'm going to tell you about some simple properties of gravity amplitudes. And the part that I find very surprising is that something this simple could be hiding in the S matrix and the scattering amplitudes of gravity, and also that something really remarkable is hiding in the scattering amplitudes of Yang-Mills theory. And maybe up front I should be clear, I'm not talking about any kind of exotic theory here. I'm talking about the same theory of gravity that's holding you down in your seat, the same theory of Yang-Mills that's holding your protons together. This is just the standard theories that we know and love and we use every day. So the main paper I'll be talking about is two papers. This is with my former students, Jan Joseph Carrasco and Henrik Johansson. And then also I'll be saying a little bit about ultraviolet properties of supergravity, which is an application of these ideas that I'll be telling you about. And that's work we did with Lance Dixon and Radu Roybon as well, and also some papers that are going to appear. In fact, Carrasco and Johansson should be putting out a paper today. I don't know. But anyway, it'll be very soon. And there's also, as many other people have contributed to this, but you know, I won't go through and say exactly who did what at what point, but there's been a lot of checks of what I'll be talking about, proofs and examples, and also various extensions, and also unraveling some underlying properties. Okay, so the general outline is going to be, first I'm going to make some general comments on gravity, you know, the usual thing that none of us can resist, which is to show you how not to do gravity, which is basically to use Feynman diagrams. And then the key for understanding gravity turns out to be to understand Yang-Mills. So there's something hiding in Yang-Mills, again, the same theory we work on every single day, that's really the key for unraveling gravity, and that has to do with a relationship between color and kinematics. So I'm going to show you that, in a very precise sense, there's an algebra inside Yang-Mills scattering amplitudes of the kinematic pieces, which look just like the color pieces. And these are going to be Jacobi relations and then various other algebraic properties. And once this is set up, then it turns out that gravity scattering amplitudes are, in a sense, trivialized. And what I mean by that is, as soon as you've put the Yang-Mills in the proper form, then immediately you can write down corresponding gravity amplitudes. And at loop level, it'll be at the integrand level, not the integrated level. I mean, one day I hope it'll be at the integrated level. But OK, so far so good, at least for going between the integrands of Yang-Mills and the integrands of gravity. Then, this being a tutorial, I just can't resist. I have to give you homework. So it'll be homework assignments. And if you don't want to do it, just you should get your graduate student to do it. And then I'm going to finish up with a non-trivial application to show you what we use this for, at least as one application. So first, let's start out with some general comments. So I just put on the blackboard, this you know and love, that's the Yang-Mills vertex, right? Nothing more to it. This is the gravity vertex, but I didn't have the patience to write down all 100 terms in it. But there's already in this vertex here, you can already see a problem, and it's actually a pretty serious problem. You notice right here, eta mu alpha. Well, the graviton, right, it's a symmetric traceless tensor. That is a trace term. So that is garbage. This is unphysical. Right? So already on line one, you see a problem with this. And in fact, the entire mess of the 100 terms in this vertex is precisely associated with propagation of unphysical degrees of freedom. So to clean it up, of course, by now you know what the answer is go on shell. So let's have a look what happens if you go on shell. And Nima already explained a little bit about this. I'm going to not use spinner helicity except in certain spots. So let's just do it the old-fashioned way without using any spinners. So then what happens is the Yang-Mills vertex. So let's just write this, the Yang-Mills vertex. Let's call it V3ABC. And we're now going on shell. So not too much happens to the Yang-Mills vertex. You could clean it up a little bit, but it's basically the same vertex. So let me write this as a K1 sigma, A to mu nu, plus cyclic. Okay, now let's have, okay, so not too much happened here, but let's now have a look at what happens to gravity. So the gravity vertex, well, I'm going to go on shell. These are the polarization vectors, so I'm going to use now polarization tensors. So what happens is, let's put in the coupling constant. First, I have my polarization tensors, so epsilon mu alpha 1, epsilon nu beta, epsilon 3 sigma gamma. Okay, and then if you take this mess, just go on shell, clean it up, what you're going to find is a really remarkable collapse. What happens is you get two copies of this. We get K1 sigma A to mu nu plus cyclic, and then another copy of it, K1 gamma A to alpha beta plus cyclic. And first thing to notice, the most important thing, is that it's two copies. It's the same kinematic vertex, but then you get two copies. Now, what's really remarkable about what you see here, is that the entire content of the scattering amplitudes is contained in this vertex. This is all I need to build the entire S matrix. And the way we do it is we can use BCFW, and that gives us all the tree amplitudes, and we can do this in D dimensions if we really feel like it, or you could do it in four dimensions, and then we go to David's talk, and he tells us about the unitarity method, and through the unitarity method, we can take these trees and turn them into loop amplitudes, and all we need is this. So you know the infinite complications of gravity, there's infinitely many vertices. Yes, it's true, but they're all irrelevant. They contain no physical content, and more precisely, not only do they contain no physical content, they are completely irrelevant as far as the S matrix is concerned. Okay?
You're speaking about just graviton scattering.
Yes, just graviton scattering. They're completely irrelevant. And the same statement is true for Yang-Mills, although here it's less surprising. I just say the four-point vertex is irrelevant. Okay, here we have an infinite number of vertices that are irrelevant. Okay, and Nima already showed us very clean forms of these vertices. So let's use spinner helicity. So with spinners, yes? It's because Large Z behavior. Once you've chosen your shifts properly, then that vertex is irrelevant.
You mean it's fixed?
No. I mean it's irrelevant that you do not need it in the construction. So you know how BCFW works, right? You start from the three-point amplitude, and then you recurse to the four-point amplitude. And the only reason why this is so, if you want to think of it in terms of gauges, is because you have chosen a very special gauge. So it's not like automatic that it disappears. You have to choose your shifts properly. Okay. And it's all in that large Z behavior.
Right, but if I take a Lagrangian and drop the foreground interaction piece, I get some nonsense, right?
No, you don't get nonsense because I could reconstruct the entire S matrix just from the three-point vertices. So if I wrote Lagrangian as three-point vertices plus dot dot dot, I never have to look at the dot, 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 as far as the S matrix is concerned.
Is he asking a question?
Yeah.
What if I added an F to the fourth term?
You need that.
Right.
I'm talking about just Einstein gravity here. If there are higher dimension operators, then you need those higher dimension operators.
So it's not a unique prescription, but it's exactly what you would get to reproduce.
It's Einstein gravity, yeah. You get exactly Einstein gravity. This is exactly Einstein. This is exactly Yang-Mills. This is exactly Einstein gravity.
But do we know that if the doping behavior persists, then when you...
That's the entire content of my talk, right? This is, you could say, okay, well, that's very nice. Your three vertex has this property. But in fact, I'm going to show you the entire S matrix has this property. And that is a non-trivial statement, okay?
No, I mean, when you add in all these higher dimensional operators.
Oh, no, that has not been studied in great detail. I think at least for certain classes of operators, I'm pretty sure it's just going to work, but this has not been studied in great detail, exactly how this works for higher dimension operators. But I'm sure that there is, in fact, exactly the same kind of double copy property in all this, everything I'm talking about will carry over to certain classes of higher dimension operators. It's just that you add higher dimension operators here, and then the double copy is certain higher dimension operators there.
Intuitively, for example, you'd expect if it's a higher dimension operator that comes from taking low energy limiters.
Yeah, exactly. So in fact, in string theory, this double copy property is understood. So in fact, when you can immediately spot the operators that'll work, because it'll be the ones that appear in the low energy limit of the string theory. Okay, so let's take D equals 4 and let's rewrite these vertices. So remember, Nima had this MHV vertex, and let's dress it up with color. Now I'm going to modify my FABCs because I don't want to carry around root 2s. So let me take, actually, why don't I take G goes to 1, so I don't have to carry that around. Let me take cap over 2 goes to 1, so I don't have to carry around the gravitational coupling constant. And then, while I'm at it, let me redefine, let me take FABC, twiddle, is I root 2 FABC. And that's just so I don't get any root 2s floating around. And those root 2s will be coming from the definitions of these polarization vectors, properly normalized ones. Okay, and then the anti-MHV vertex, ABC minus G, FABC. Okay, I'm still keeping my G, but that won't last long. Okay, then 1, 2 cubed, and then 2, 3, and then 3, 1. Okay, and as Nima explained, in fact, there's only one thing you can write for gravity. If you just think about the spinner weight and the dimensions, then you can only write down one object. And that one object for gravity, so let's make it minus minus plus, you won't be surprised, is going to be the square 2, 3. 3, 1, square it, and then plus plus minus is equal to I, and again, you won't be surprised, 1, 2 cubed over 2, 3, 3, 1, okay, square it. Okay, and Nima derived it by saying it's the only thing you could write down, which is basically correct. And it's the same squaring you see here. Yes, exactly. It's call it the spinner weight, or we call it phase weight or spinner weight. It's the transformations under Lorentz transformations, and then also dimensions, and then it's the only thing you can write down. Okay. Okay. So So far you say, well, oh gee, that's pretty cute. The three vertex has this property, but what I'm going to show you is the entire S matrix, and conjectured, not proven, to all loop orders that the same is true, that you get this double copy. Okay, so first thing is we now have to get to item two on the list, is we need to understand Yang-Mills a little bit better. We're going to rearrange your Yang-Mills amplitudes. So the way the rearrangement goes, okay, so now we're talking about Yang-Mills, is we're going to rewrite these in terms of cubic diagrams. By cubic diagrams, I just mean the diagrams that you would have in a phi cube theory. So if I have some scattering, then I'm going to organize it in terms of cubic diagrams. Now, the first thing you'll tell me, but wait a second, everybody knows that Yang-Mills has a quartic vertex. But that's kind of trivial, because suppose I have a quartic vertex. What am I going to do to it? Well, I'm going to explode it out like so. And the way I do that, let's say this is a propagator with momentum p, is I use this identity, p squared over p squared is equal to 1. So I insert the propagator, and then I put in a numerator factor that just eats it. Okay, so this is just trivial. So with this trivial rearrangement, what I can do is rewrite the endpoint tree amplitude as a sum over numerators, color factors, and propagators. So this would be over diagrams called I. The index is I. So this is color. So by the color, it'll just be FABCs. The numerator, this is the numerator. And these are the Feynman propagators. No color ordering, absolutely not. Right, so it looks like we're going backwards in time. We're getting rid of color ordering, and then we're also introducing diagrams that look like Feynman diagrams. So this looks like backwards motion, but okay, this is the way the construction goes. Okay, now, what do I mean, just to be explicit, what do I mean by this? Well, let's just write down some examples of what I mean. You know, I just want to be clear. I'm not saying anything deep right now. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4. So this thing, this looks like an S channel diagram. S is equal to K1 plus K2 square. Then the color factor, let's call it CS, is just F A1, A2, B. Let's make this B. And then F, and then B, A3, A4. Nothing profound, okay? And then what's the numerator? Well, the numerator, I'm not going to write down in any detail, especially if I don't use spinor helicity. Then it's a little bit complicated. But I just mean exactly what you find in the textbooks, plus dot, dot, dot. So it's just some collection of polarization vectors and momenta. And then by the propagators, so let's take... what's that?
Included in there is a p squared.
Yeah, there could, right. In here there could in fact be a term that goes S and then some other stuff. Which can eat that. Yeah, there could be contact terms. No problem with the contact terms.
I mean, there are more than one way to explore this 4-point vector.
Yes.
So what do you do exactly?
So the idea is color. Right, thanks for bringing that up. So I need to know which channel to explode it in. So I just pick a term in here, and then according to the color, I match the color, because the numerator, for this to make sense, that numerator had better be associated with that color factor. And that's tagged by the, you could say the color factor determines which diagram it is, and that determines which propagator it is, and that tells you what to do there. Yes, exactly, right. Yes, I meant to say that. Thanks for bringing that up. So the propagator, that's just S. So that's all very simple. Now, what do color factors do for a living? Well, being color factors, they satisfy the Jacobi identity. Okay, so the Jacobi identity tells us that if I'm looking at the color factors, so I'm writing down diagrams for color. So these are now color diagrams. So let's make this 1, 2, 3, 4. Four, and then Jacobi identities, I cycle that around. So this becomes 3, 1, 2, 2, 3, 1, and that equals 0. Or I can write this in another way, that if this is S, this is U, and this is T, I have CS plus CU plus CT is equal to 0. Now, I can also talk about higher point amplitudes. If I, let's say, take leg number 4, and I just get rid of them and kind of extend them, so there's, I'm just extending it to some bigger diagram. See, it's the same Jacobi identity, right? So it's still equal to 0. So this key statement is the following. For every color Jacobi identity, there is a representation that the numerators have the same identity. Okay, so suppose I have 3 diagrams and they're chosen so that they satisfy the color Jacobi identity. And this just is this just labels the diagram. Okay? Then the statement is that there exists a representation such that the numerators satisfy exactly the same identity. Now, notice I didn't tell you how to get this. I'm just telling you it exists. Okay? And suppose I have an anti-symmetry. Notice if I flip over 1 and 2, the color factor has an anti-symmetry. So suppose that I have an anti-symmetry that takes the color factor to minus itself under some flip of legs, then the numerator should have exactly the same. Okay, and I'm just asserting that this exists. Okay, now the non-trivial surprise, well, first you could say it's a non-trivial surprise that it exists, but you might say, what of it? I mean, it's kind of neat, but what of it? Well, the what of it is that as soon as we've done this, then I have gravity for free. Okay, so I have a tree M, so we're still talking about tree level, is, I'm just copying from there, is the sum over the diagrams I and then Ni Ci over Di. Then the claim is, so this is Yang-Mills, the claim is, write it like this, M tree, and now this is going to be gravity, is the square, like so, and this is gravity. Now, what theory of gravity am I talking about here? I am talking about Einstein gravity. So the Lagrangian is is just our square root of gr. Right? Nothing fancy. Okay. Now, for this to make sense, the first thing is we really need to be talking about on-shell amplitudes. So these amplitudes are on-shell. I do believe an off-shell representation exists where this is satisfied, but I can tell you it's not so easy to find it. Okay. The kinematic one does. Yeah, the color one does not, but the kinematic one does. So if you were to pick Feynman gauge, for argument's sake, and say, oh, let's give it a try, we'll take the contact terms and do something to them, you will find that this does not work beyond like 5 points and beyond. Okay.
What happens to the polarization?
What's that? Oh, they're hidden in here. So I think I have it here. So yeah. So the numerator, for example, you see contains the polarizations.
How do you map the polarization?
Oh, yes, you map it like this. Right, I see what you're saying. Okay, now I understand your question. Like so. So you see this product, right? Because you get the product, just replace it. Yeah, anyway, just make the replacement.
Yeah. Yeah, but you get mixed terms.
No, you don't. It's multilinear. Remember, it's multilinear in the polarization. So when you square it, you just get every single term will have two gluon polarizations of the same leg. Okay, so no mixed terms. Yeah. Now,
you said there is a representation of which this is true.
Yes.
Right,
you have to find this representation.
It has to be in the right.
Right. So the key is, it's all in Yang-Mills. The key is, you need to find the Yang-Mills representation that has this property. As soon as you have this property working, the claim is gravity is free.
And you found it for orbitary angle.
Yeah, oh yeah, there's explicit representation. All those people I erased. In fact, there's a proofs at tree level. There's explicit representations at tree level that have this for arbitrary numbers of legs.
What
so at tree level, it's proven.
What
yeah.
There's
actually a very strong ambiguity. You can make the following shift. Let's look up here. So what I'm So n's in general, never mind this constraint, have a very large ambiguity just given by the following constraint that if I take ni goes to ni plus delta I, and delta I is anything I please, just subject to the constraint that the sum of delta I ci over di is equal to zero, then that's okay. But it's only a subset of these that preserve this property. The full understanding of exactly what changes you can make and preserve this property has not been mapped out, especially at loop level.
Okay, so when you write down the gravity amplitude as a part Taylor square, so what is the order of the
I'm going to work through an example at 4 points to show you explicitly how this works. Okay.
If you do the diagram sum of gravity, do you have to explode out all the point vertices?
Sorry, what's this?
You're summing over the diagrams for the gravity scattering.
Right. It's only the phi cubed. So you see this sum here,
and
they're identical. So the claim is that all those contact terms are just hidden inside these numerators. That in these numerators obtained from Yang-Mills.
But the NI ones came from exploding the 4-point vertices in Yang-Mills. But you never have to explode the 5 and 6-point vertices in gravity?
No. Well, the philosophy is the following, that gravity is like an afterthought. So everything is being done in Yang-Mills. So we just construct these ends in Yang-Mills. Once we have the ends in Yang-Mills, we don't do anything to get gravity. We just take that C and replace it with another N. So there's no exploding out or anything like you have to do on the gravity side.
The ends of the diagrams are determined by the external states in the Yang-Mills theory.
Yes.
And then you use that same sum in gravity.
Exactly.
Without recomputing which term.
Exactly. It's exactly the same set of diagrams. Okay. It's all hidden in there somehow. Yeah. Okay. It's something important which will be part of the homework assignment is that this all works in D dimensions. Okay. I mean, most of the proofs and most of the explicit examples are four-dimensional ones, but anyway, you can take my word that it works in D dimensions. At least tree level, not loop level. There's no proof of essentially anything I'm saying. Still a conjecture. Okay. So how do we generalize this? So here I was talking about Einstein gravity, and if you're watching carefully, you may have noticed that the state count doesn't really match. So if I take Yang-Mills times Yang-Mills, I don't, let's say in four dimensions, Yang-Mills times Yang-Mills is four states, right? It's not two states, but gravity has two states. Where's the mismatch? The mismatch comes from the fact that included in here would be could also be an anti-symmetric tensor and a dilaton. But if I'm only considering pure Einstein gravity, just a pure graviton scattering, all those other states decouple at tree level, right? They're like another sector, or you could think of it, you also get anti-symmetric tensors and dilatons for free from this formula if you're so interested in computing that. At loop level, of course, you can't ignore this. Okay.
So when you do this replacement of polarization tensor epsilon mu with
right.
You symmetrize the...
So, yeah, so that's right. So let's say you're interested in gravity amplitude, you would take that epsilon mu nu and you would plug in the symmetrized traceless tensor of gravity. If you were interested in the anti-symmetric tensor, then you'd plug in an anti-symmetric polarization tensor. Or if you're interested in the dilaton, you plug in a trace. Okay. So just some simple generalizations. So let's move away from pure gravity. Let's go to theories that are supersymmetric. So, for example, if we wanted n equals 1 supergravity, how could we get it? Well, the idea is we would take this formula here and we would modify it a little bit. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a generalization of that formula, just a modest one. And, let's make this m, that's gravity. And I will make the second copy to be a different one, a different theory. So let's say I'm interested in n equals 1 supergravity. So let's try n equals 1 supergravity. The way I would do it is I would take n equals 1 super Yang-Mills and times a copy of n equals 0 super Yang-Mills. And the precise theory I'm talking about, you could map out exactly what the states are. It's just the direct product of the states. Or the theory that I'll talk about at the end will be n equals 8 supergravity.
Sorry, what is n equals
0 supergravity? Oh, yes. Right. For those of you who are phenomenologists may not be familiar with this theory. It's ordinary Yang-Mills. Right? Because the world is supersymmetric. What? No. Yeah. No great Gino. It's just ordinary. Yeah. Yeah, n is the number of great Gino. Yeah, sorry about that. This is just ordinary Yang-Mills. That's just ordinary Yang-Mills. So actually, that's also true that if I was, if I wanted, on this side, there'd be a problem because let's say I modified this, so I made this one n equals 1 super Yang mills, then it'd be cross terms between the fermions here and the fermions here, which would then give me some extra states on this side, and in fact I'd have n equals 2 supergravity. So it's whatever states you find in the direct product, you have to find on the other side.
It's only the external states.
Yeah, it's only the external states.
Look at the subset of this.
Yeah, you can. Right, right. In fact, at tree level, all of these theories, if I said like pure graviton, for example, then this theory is just Einstein gravity again. Okay, so this would be n equals 4 super Yang mills times n equals 4 super Yang mills. Okay? Now let's work out an example. I just want to show you an example of how this works. So I want to show you numerators that satisfy this. Now, it turns out that at 4 points, basically anything you do will work. Okay, so that means ordinary Feynman diagrams have this property. It's at higher points where it becomes non-trivial. Okay, so so let's do an example. So this example will be four gluons. Okay, so we have three color structures, 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 3, 2, 4 minus 1, 2, 3, 4 equals 0. So this would be a color of the S channel, this is color of the U channel, and this is color of the T channel. You may notice my signs flipped around, but that's just because I'm drawing the diagrams a little bit differently. Okay. So that's an important point. There's some ambiguity, let's say, in this sign here, because if I take this diagram and flip, I get a minus sign. But the idea is it's correlated with the numerator sign, so that the sign of this is irrelevant because this one tracks that sign. Okay. So exactly how I write my Jacobi identity is not so important. So let me now eliminate the color T minus CU. So you can just take your Feynman diagrams, and wherever you see this color factor, you just replace it by those two. And if you do that, then the tree amplitude can be written in a color decomposed form. I'm not going to bother putting in those commas. CS, and then A4, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then plus CU, A4, 1, 3, 2, 4. So that's this guy, and there's this guy. Okay? And these guys here, these are our friends. These are the color-ordered partial amplitudes. So these are the color-ordered. Now, this is not the usual color decomposition. Normally, we use a trace basis. This uses adjoint representation. In fact, this is a simplest example of a color decomposition that was constructed by Del Duca, Dixon, and Maltoni. But anyway, here it is. And these guys, anyway, are our friends, the same ones that appear in the other color decomposition. So let's write down what the value of those amplitudes are. The good thing is we don't have to calculate them because we know them. Okay, so this, let me make it two negative helicities, two positive helicities. I'm using helicity, otherwise I can't write it on the blackboard. So we know what that formula is. This is the lowest of the Park-Taylor amplitudes, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4, 4, 1. And then you're going to ask me, where's the propagator? I need, for this decomposition, I need to identify what my propagators are. Okay, but that's not such a big deal because I just have to rationalize this. Okay, so if we rationalize it, it's minus I 1, 2 square, 3, 4 square, divided by ST. Okay, the propagators have been mushed together, so it's like having taken two diagrams and put them on a common denominator. That's why I have two propagators there. Then let me write down the other amplitude. Okay, so the other amplitude is A1, 3, 2, 4. So the other color ordering. Okay, so that's 1, 2 to the 4th. There's an I. And then it's just the denominator. It's 1, 3, 3, 2, 2, 4, and then 4, 1. Okay, now what I need to do is I have to put this in a form where I can see numerators and denominators. So let me just define this. Maybe that's too low, so let me define it on the side here. Let me define some numerators. So let's define this to be equal to ns over nt. Oh, sorry, over s. Ns over s. And then plus nt over t. Notice there's no color factor because, of course, this is a color-ordered amplitude, but I can still identify the numerators that would appear in this color-ordered amplitude because it's a subset of the diagrams. Okay. And then here, this thing here is going to be minus nt over t plus nu over u. Now, this minus sign here, let's see where that came from. So notice the order 1, 3, 2, 4. Notice that this is out of order 1, 3, 2, 4. So I have to flip that. So there's an extra minus sign in my NT that appears in this amplitude because of that anti-symmetry. Okay, so there's some signs that you have to track. So one more thing. Let me write this thing now in the same form as over there. If I write it in the same form, I get minus I 1, 2 to the 4th, sorry, 1, 2 square, 3, 4 square, and then divided by, you can notice the poles here, I have a T-channel pole and a U-channel pole, so it's going to be TU. Okay, so now what do I do? I need to find, I'm looking for numerators that satisfy this equation. I want nt is equal to cs minus cu. Ns minus nu. Okay? That's the equation I want. And the question is, are there numerators that satisfy this? So I stare at this for a little bit, and I say, aha, I got one. I'm going to take ns equals nu, and I'm going to take that to be equal to minus I 1, 2, 3, 4, divided by t. That'll be my numerator. Notice it's non-local. But I didn't tell you that the numerator has to be local. Okay? It can be whatever it wants. That's not the propagator. In the S channel, the propagator is S. Right? So I don't want to include the S, because that's the propagator. And everything else I call the numerator. And then NT, I take equals 0.
Sorry, I'm so confused. Didn't you define an S and
NT
already?
Yeah, what's defined here is the sum has to be this.
I mean, there are three equations and three unknowns, right?
What three?
Three equations and three unknowns.
Where do you see three?
Well, down there, up here, and then the condition.
No, there's an ambiguity. You can there's actually no the counting is actually not correct.
Until you put the equation on the box, it's okay.
Yeah.
But if I put the equation in the box there, right?
No, you will find that if you check consistency, there's an ambiguity in the you can say a gauge symmetry that you can move around the value of this. You can toss things between the between different terms. But for the purposes, what's that?
Oh.
Well, in fact, no, in fact.
Sorry, I'm not.
There's a linear dependence in here. Yeah, exactly. This is the origin of the fact that you have fewer equations than you think. That's exactly right. Okay. Okay. In fact.
In the NS menu,
in the brackets. Sorry. Exactly. It's just copying from here. Right. So, in fact, it turns out because of this, this, which then causes, you could say, a gauge symmetry in the choices of these NS and NP and NU, in fact, any gauge is going to work. Go home, try Feynman diagrams, try light cone gauge, whatever you like, you will find. As soon as you impose the condition that you have chosen NS, NU, and NT such that you get the correct amplitude, you will find that the Jacobi identity, this thing is automatically satisfied at 4 points. Now, that brings me to my first homework assignment. Many of you look skeptical. Well, there's a way of curing that, which is to do a homework assignment. So homework number one is work out A 1 2 3 4, and you're welcome to use Feynman diagrams. But if you're in the Harmony program, don't tell anybody. Okay, in fact, it's you don't want to use spinners on this because of the next homework assignment. So we work out this, and then what you do is, this procedure that, well, you have your three diagrams, 1, 2, 3, 4, 2, 3, 1, 4, 3, 1, 2, 4, and then what you do is, this fellow here, you explode him out according to the color. Now, the color of this guy, by the way, is ambiguous because we have the color Jacobi identity. So if I have one color factor, I can turn it into the other two. But I don't care. Do it any way you want. Use the Jacobi identity. Don't use the Jacobi identity. Anyway, just explode it out according to the color. Okay, and then what you do is you then write down some diagrams, and the constraint is that the NS, NU, and NT that you pick, they have to add up to give the correct amplitude. And then you will find, you should go home and you could check, the first part of the homework is check NU plus NS plus NT is equal to 0, and maybe those are the right signs for what I did here. Because, like I say, the signs depend on how you draw the diagrams. Okay, so that's pretty simple, but now you say, okay, that's very nice, but what of it? So now what you should do is go write down NS square over S plus NT square over T plus NU square over U, and you should compare it to the truth. Now you can use spinners. Compare it to gravity. So this is the gravity amplitude computed by independent means, including Feynman diagrams if you feel like it. But anyway, this is the answer that you should get. You should get that the gravity tree is equal to I of I times 1/2 to the sixth. Let's make this 1 - 2 - 3 + 4 + is equal to 1/2 to the sixth, and then 3 - 4, 2 - 3, 4 - 1. Okay, 2 - 4, 3 - 4, and then 3 - 1. Okay, and so anyway, you can check to see that it's really true and it all works. Okay, but then this brings to the second homework assignment, which is actually kind of amusing because no one has worked this out, including me. So it's actually a very nice homework. You should give it to your graduate student if you don't want to do it. And then your graduate student, you go write a paper. So the homework number two is what you should do now is take this formula here that you did in D dimensions, so you use Feynman diagrams, nothing fancy, and go back and recall ADD in extra dimensions. So let's go to D equals 5, for example. Right? And then what you do is you do your Kaluza-Klein, right? And then you get some expression, and now you have massive gravitons, right? So now you have scattering between massive gravitons. And then what you do is you want to make sure, is this thing really working right? So then what you do is you go to the literature and find yourself some Feynman rules. So what you do is you compare to the Feynman rules are given in this paper. So they don't do the graviton scattering case because in the initial state you don't have gravitons, you have quarks and so on. But anyway, this is just a warm up. So it's HEP pH 98111350. And then you say, well, gee, that was boring because I can't use this in a collider. So let's make it useful in a collider. So what we're going to do is we're going to modify the double copy. This is now two copies of gluons, which gives you a graviton. So let's just modify it. So let's repeat the exercise. But this time, copy one, what we're going to do is we're going to consider this amplitude, like this, and there's other diagrams. And this is copy one. And copy two, so this is now a fermion. Okay, and then copy two, what we're going to do is replace it with a scalar. And a fermion times a scalar is a fermion. A gluon times a gluon is a graviton. So that means that I now have, this implies that I now have QQ goes to two gravitons. Now you might complain I'm in the wrong representation because this is adjoint representation for these guys, but anyway, that's a minor thing. You could easily correct that. Okay, and anyway, so this then gives you this amplitude, and you know you can check against this paper whether it's actually correct.
Actually, I think there's a mistake in that paper.
Oh, then don't use those Feynman rules. You should use the Feynman rules of yeah, that's right, Giudice, Ratazzi, and Wells. You can use that as well. But yeah, that'd be kind of bad if there was if there was an error. But this is pretty. These are pretty simple. I assume these are given correctly. At least the Feynman rules you need for that.
This language, I don't remember,
but they must have corrected it.
Yeah, they didn't.
Oh, they didn't.
I had some communication with them.
Hey, Joe, go correct it. Okay. What's that? Yeah, okay. Yeah, graviton. We can also play games with gluons by taking a copy of like a scalar and a gluon. So you get back a gluon. Okay.
Okay. Sorry,
So you want to say, that this correspondence holds when you do the KK decomposition?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because so, right, it just holds in five dimensions.
So then, at what point does it depend on the fact that the extra dimension is flat in this case?
Well, at the starting point. So I begin with an amplitude that's, you know, flat space in five dimensions, then I just do a compactification on it, right? So on line one, it's a correct equation. You know, the scattering amplitude in five dimensions done this way or that way, they have to be identical. Maybe I should mention, for the scalars, the type of theory you want is you need to add there's an extra group theory index on this. There's a paper, if you get confused by that, there's a paper which is myself. And Wang, which talks about decompositions like this. It's an older paper. So it talks about decompositions like that, but it's not in this language. But that should be enough to straighten out any group theory issues.
I'm just asking to what extent does this carry over for the
No, there it does not in any obvious way. Because at this point in time,
KK picture, the only difference is that the KK masses are not evenly spaced.
I thought there was a cosmological constant.
Yeah. No, from the effective 48 picture.
No, the wave function is different. The interaction is different.
Yeah. Well, on line one, you've got to have an expression which is flat space, or we don't know how to do that. We don't know whether it works, and it hasn't been studied, really.
Have to extend the formula to a space.
Right. And we do not know how to do that. Let me say a little bit more about loops. So I'll try to finish in 15 minutes, if that's okay. You're the boss, so. So how does this extend to loop level? And the answer to that question is really remarkable, because it's the most idiotic, simplest thing you could write down. So on line one, you know, you just say, oh, it's got to look like this. So you say, well, I guess it must look like this, that the L loop, right? So at L loops, what we're going to have is the product J equals 1 to L, so this is the integration measure, d dl over 2 pi to the g. Okay, it's a loop diagram, so it better have integrals. Then you sum over the diagrams, and again, these are phi cube diagrams. Then you've got a numerator factor, and that numerator factor has loop momentum in it. You have color factor, and then you have propagators. So it's exactly the same. And then, well, here's color. And then maybe one more small thing, which is that there can be a symmetry factor. So let's put this in. This is a symmetry factor. OK, what do I mean by a symmetry factor? I just mean this has a 1/2. OK, that's no surprise. OK, so the first part is that there exists a representation. This is the claim, unproven. There exists a representation such that the numerators satisfy the same algebra as the color factors.
Are these products of propagators?
Yes, these are the product of propagators. All Feynman propagators.
All different products?
It's there's a diagram. So for a given diagram.
It's a cubic diagram.
Yeah, it's a cubic diagram. And for a given diagram, it's all the propagators that appear in this diagram.
I think, I don't know, it's just a question. Mm-hmm. You probably talk about, but naively, if you do that, the square of the angles,
yeah,
then you get the internal lines or anti-symmetric deductions, so it should work on the...
Right. It's certainly more general than string theory, but if we're talking about pure gravity now, then you're absolutely right that the theory we now have is not pure Einstein gravity. We would have to remove states. We need some projectors. So this formula, actually not this formula, because I haven't done the double copy yet, but the formula I'm about to write down, you're absolutely right that it is not as simple as that. However, it's very simple for theories we're really interested in, such as n equals 8 supergravity or supergravity theories, immediately are the right theory.
So the claim here is what? Is the sum of n equals 0?
So far the main claim is right here. The claim is there exists a representation such that if you have C alpha plus C beta plus C gamma is equal to 0, then N alpha plus N beta plus N gamma is also equal to 0. That's the main claim so far, that there exists such a representation. Okay, notice I'm not telling you how to construct it. The construction of these objects is not completely trivial, but the existence is really what's going to be very important for us.
And I'm always driven by the color.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Okay, always driven by the color.
Is that a conjecture or something?
What's that? Yes, this is a conjecture. The existence of this is extremely non-trivial, and the reason is why it's so non-trivial is because this imposes a lot of constraints on it, and you still have to get the right answer. Okay, but then on the other hand, you have a lot of extra freedom because these contact terms can be moved around, and the question of how the freedom balances against the restrictions, we don't have the answer to. Okay, I'll make some comments about where we've
given
proven
the freedom we have in instructing in alpha. Is it clear that you always get the same gravity amplitude?
Yes, it is.
Which is a different n.
Yes. It is clear. But I have to explain. Maybe I can explain that offline.
Does the Yang Mills group have to be SUN?
No, this is any color group. I never used anything about this except for the Jacobi identity and the anti-symmetry. Okay, so it can be any gauge group.
This means that for three graphs, what is this here?
Right. In fact, this line here was supposed to be, I didn't mean to erase that. The line here was supposed to be of the graph that I was about to write down. Okay. So let's see what does this mean. So what I need is another color. So I'm going to take one leg to be special. Okay. And we're going to keep an eye on that leg. And the claim is that as far as the color is concerned and the numerator, so this is not a formula for the diagram including the propagator. I'm about to write down a formula just for the color or for the numerator. So we can call this, let's say, C1. So we do the Jacobi identity, and that's given by, except I should have put in the color. Let's put it colored. So that's the special leg. And then minus and again, I should color this guy. Okay, and then while I'm coloring it, let me also encircle it so we can see where the Jacobi is acting. So in the blue circle is where the Jacobi is happening. Okay? And this is off-shell. There's no cut constraints or anything like that. This is an off-shell equation for color factors. C2, C3, or we can make it N1, N2, and N3. Okay, and the claim is that such a representation exists. Okay, now let's suppose we have such a representation. The second part of the conjecture, and by the way, this is the mild part of the conjecture. The really non-trivial part is the first part, the existence of such a representation, is that we do exactly the same integral, j equals 1 to l d dl on 2 pi to the d, and then it's the sum over exactly the same diagram. So these are cubic diagrams, okay, and then ni twiddle, so that's the second copy. There's a symmetry factor. Exactly the same symmetry factor. These symmetry factors are just the symmetry factors of phi cube theory. And that claim is that if you want, for example, n equals 8 supergravity, you just take two copies of n equals 4 super Yang Mills. Okay. And this is, like I say, this is all conjecture. So the first thing is,
this is proven.
What's that? I'm about to say that, right. So the question is, why should you believe me? That's a good question. So what evidence do we have? So,
before that, do you worry about the ghost?
No, we do not worry about the ghost because they're included. It's whatever the amplitude is, including ghosts or however you do. Let's suppose you did it by Feynman diagram, so there'd be ghosts. That's all included. Right, there's a diagram, and just whatever contributed, ghosts or anything else, or fermions or scalars or whatever is in the theory, you put in there. Okay. So the question is, why should you believe us? And of course, the answer is, to believe the full conjecture, that I don't know, but we certainly have some evidence. Now, the place that you can collect the evidence the fastest to the highest loop orders and the largest numbers of legs is, no surprise, n equals 4 super Yang Mills, because we know a lot about that theory. So, tree level, it's proven. If you look at n equals 4 super Yang Mills and n equals 8 supergravity, okay, let's look at 4 points. Then we got 1, 2, 3, and 4 loops. 4 loops we're going to write up soon. So we've checked this explicitly. We just know it's true because we did the calculation and we were able to find such a representation. For 5 points in this theory, then we have 1, 2, 3 loops. And this is the paper that's going to come out soon from Carrasco and Johansson. We also have lower point evidence in cases with less supersymmetry. Lower loop. So one loop, we have evidence, but it's still a conjecture. Sorry, what's that?
The conjecture. Your conjecture is about the integrand.
Yes, about the integrand.
So, in which sense this has a unique meaning with respect to what looping you are doing? I mean, different loops around.
Different loops?
Routings. I mean, you can choose
the momentum.
Right. Very good. So, notice in this that the rest of the diagram is identical in all cases. That means if I just give this a label, L1, L2, L3, L4, then the labeling is the same. Okay. Oops. Yeah, that's probably L4, L3. No, because it's this. It's the momenta of this one, so it's whatever. Let me write it down here, and then it'll be okay. Okay. So it's just there's a blob here, and I just insert the blob in the same place. Now, if I go look at a different Jacobi identity, my labels move around, explaining why no one has seen this before.
So when you say you have some results, you don't need the full answer to make this proven. You don't only the integral.
Integrand. Yes, you need the integrand, but
not the full answer to
that. But we are talking about. Very, very high loop order. It still could be non-trivial to find a construction like this.
But this particular example seems to follow directly from your tree because you're inserting different tree.
Except, remember, I said that the on-shellness is very important for it to work smoothly. These legs are all off-shell, and that actually imposes very non-trivial constraints between the whole set of Jacobi relations. So even at 5-point tree, right? Let's go to 5-point tree level. You could have said exactly the same thing, that, oh, it worked at 4 points, it worked here, therefore it's trivial. But this leg went off shell, and that, in fact, causes the relations to be non-trivial. It's basically some contact terms that have to be pushed in the right spot for this relation to work. Okay?
It seems to me that the first and the third are the same internal blob, not as
well. It just
looks.
Oh.
It looks like
I did something. He's right. He's actually right. I'm sorry. You are actually correct, because it's the rest of the diagram that has to be the same. I had it backwards. Yeah, sorry about that. That's what happens when you stand too close to something. Okay. Let's make this 3 and then 4. There you go. Okay? No, absolutely right. Otherwise, it's not the Jacobi relation. Very good. Okay. Let's see if there is. What do we use this for? And the answer is that it gives you very good power to do non-planar. So all the advances you heard about that Nima spoke about, and then Marcus is going to speak about advances, they're all in planar Yang nils. But I want you to notice something. That's a non-planar diagram. That's planar, that's planar. So now we have a means of taking planar information, which is a lot easier to get, and converting it to non-planar. Okay, so the application is, if you're interested in supergravity, you want to know, is n equals 8 supergravity a finite theory, ultraviolet finite theory or not, for example, and you want to inspect what the theory is telling us, then we need these non-planar diagrams. So the way it works, and I'm running a little bit over, but I'm almost done. I assume people want to hear something about n equals 8. Okay. So the way it works, so let's talk about the main application we have in mind, is it completely collapses the problem of finding these numerators or finding the integrand. So let's look at three loops, for example. At three loops, what happens is that if you solve the Jacobi relations, all numerators can be expressed in terms of 1. This guy we'll call the master diagram. So all others determined by 1 diagram. 1 diagram determines all. Now, you have to have a solution that satisfies the Jacobi relation, but the basic idea is we use the Jacobi constraints to find the numerator we're looking for. Okay, and then all others, for example, here's a non-planar diagram. This one, you don't have to, or this one is just determined by this once you've solved for this. It turns out that this guy can be determined, once you impose the Jacobi relations, can be determined by a single cut. It's what we call the maximal cut, or the leading singularity of 1 diagram fixes everything. It's because the constraints are so strong from the Jacobi relations. If you go to 4 loops, then we have 2 masters. We write it in terms of planars because planar masters are easier to work with because we know so much about planar diagrams. So there's 2 master diagrams, and they determine a total. There's 85, so let's make it 83 others. Okay, and what this does is a computation of supergravity that took us more than a year, we just bang off in a day, because the entire problem is now reduced to doing it in Yang nils, right? You just have to get Yang nils lined up in a proper way with the Jacobi relations. So that's where the work is. You line up the Jacobi relation in Yang nils, and then 5 minutes later you have gravity, because you just go through and you square all the numerators. So what's the result of this? And historically, this wasn't how it was done. We figured out all the relations by doing computations the hard way, or the harder way, I should say. The result is that we know a finiteness bound. So the theory, it's finite for d less than 6 over L plus 4. And this is for L less than or equal to 4, also L greater than 1. The formula has a glitch at L equals 1, 1 loop, but that's a, never mind, it's a minor technicality. So we know this to be true. Okay, now if this formula were to be true for all loop orders, then the theory is finite because of as L goes to infinity and it disappears, you have you have a bound. In fact, this is the same bound as in n equals 4 super Yang Mills, which is known to be finite. So this is the same as n equals 4 super Yang Mills. Okay, now I should give you the latest status. So the history of this is actually very long and convoluted. This question has been around for many years, more than 30 years. To make a long story short and ignore all the confusion, here's the current consensus. And pretty much everyone working in the field, not 100%, but pretty much everyone working in the field agrees with this, that there are no available counterterms. For d equals 4, it would be L equals 7. The counterterm is some number. We don't know what that number is. And then it's a d8 r to the 4th. So it's a Riemann to the 4th. That's a derivative, a covariant derivative. Anyway, the counterterm looks like that. The question is, what's that number? Is that number 0 or not? So what people have, of course, done, not too surprisingly, is they take all available symmetries. And based on all the available symmetries, they start ruling out counterterms until they wind up here. The result, this is anyway the result of that, that there can be no counterterms up to there. So you might say, well, that's 7 loops. How are you going to get to 7 loops? Notice I just said that 4 loops is where we are, what we've done. But the answer is that this is equivalent to something slightly different. If you look at d equals 24 fifths, okay, then in that dimension, then L equals 5 has exactly the same counterterm. It's the d8 r to the 4th. And this is the key, L equals 5. If we knew what this coefficient was, if that coefficient is non-zero here, then I'm happy to declare that the theory will diverge at seven loops. On the other hand, if it's 0, then I think that people would not be wise to wager that case would have a divergence.
Are there similar examples of this, by the way? I mean, could you have done that with other counterterms and looked at other dimensions?
Yeah. It took many years for this to happen, but by now this is a completely accepted procedure in the field.
To go to some other.
This has been going on for years. It took many years until people.
So there are plenty of examples, right? The other counterterms that don't exist.
It's the same. Well, the basic point is that these two guys are connected, that for this thing to be finite, there has to be a magical cancellation. And it's the same magical cancellation that has to happen there.
Okay. Is this number rational by transcendental?
This number will certainly not be, will not be rational if it's there. The transcendentality is exactly what you expect for super Yang Mills. In fact, there's some connection between these theories, as you might expect. Oh, something important that I should point out. So you might ask me, well, look, if you've exhausted all the known symmetries, in fact, it's just supersymmetry and what's called E77 symmetry. It's a non-compact symmetry that has to do with the sigma model of the scalars, but anyway, those are the known symmetries of the theory, right? Then you come to here, but just something obvious, none of these discussions about symmetry have ruled out or have used any of this double copy, any of the symmetries associated with that. In fact, there's a paper, a recent paper. This is from O'Connell and let me get his name straight. Montiero. And what they point out is there is an extra symmetry in the self-dual case, or MHD amplitude. So it's a subset of the, it's a subset of the entire theory. There is a symmetry, which is the area-preserving diffeomorphisms. And if I say that for gravity, you're going to say yes, that's true. But notice I'm also saying it for Yang-Mills because it's the same numerators, right? So Yang-Mills seems to have an extra symmetry, but at the moment it's just the beginning. It's just in a special case, and I think that that's an example of something that's underlying that's not accounted for in any of these counterterm discussions. But anyway, I promise you this: we are going to find out the answer. The only thing I don't know is how long it'll take. Okay. They could, or they may, or they may not. So, in the conjecture, I never told you that the numerator has to be local or non-local. It can be whatever it wants, as long as it satisfies the constraint.
When you square it to go to the gravity amplitude, it becomes even more singular than it should.
Right.
Be, so there should be some
cancellation. Right. Indeed, there is a very strong symmetry, or there's a very strong cancellation because of this generalized gauge invariance. I think I mentioned it, right? It's these shifts of you take these ends and you shift them by some delta, and this delta can be anything. And if this delta has singularities, then it'll just cause a spray of singularities in the scattering amplitudes, right? But at the end, they all cancel because the same algebra which made those singularities cancel in Yang-Mills makes it cancel in gravity. And if you want to, maybe afterwards, I'll show you some more detail.
In the multi-loop diagram, these numerators can have very strong similarities, probably, because they have many possible propagators.
Well, at least the constructions we have done so far, the constructions we have done so far at 4 points, they are completely clean in the sense that they're local. There are no spurious singularities anywhere in our construction. But that does not mean that it may not be a good idea to introduce some singularities for various convenience reasons.
Yeah, so maybe
You had a discussion at tree level on shell that these four-point vertices can be converted to a three-point vertex, and you included them.
Right.
Now, when you draw your loop diagrams, you never draw any.
Right, that's correct. Right.
So this argument carries over to the loop order and doesn't change the degree of convergence or something?
So the operation of writing things as phi cubed, even at loop level, is very straightforward. If you have a contact term, well, you look at the color factor, and then that color factor tells you what diagram you want to put it in. So then you just multiply and divide by the right propagators, and the dimensions work out if you go through it. How can we? It's a count. Yeah, this particular counter term, it's just a counting argument, just dimensional analysis. Because what you do is you write down the seven loop. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Anyway, there another one. And then you write down this guy. Every vertex has two powers of momentum. Right? And then what you know is in the critical dimension, the integral becomes log divergent. So then you ask, how many momenta come out of the integral? And those momenta that come out of the integral, those momenta that come out of the integral, they're just the derivatives here and here. So there are 12 derivatives that come out, and then everything that remains behind would be a loop momentum. And then, anyway, when you do the counting, you'll find that it is this counter term, just by dimensional analysis, that corresponds to L equals 7, D equals 4.
Why is this
non-rational? Oh, that's just a log. I just meant like a log of lambda UV. It's just where the integral diverges.
Sorry.
I just meant the divergence, yeah.
Yes.
So, has it been explored what the implications of the Gantian symmetry and N equals 4 are for N equals 8
series? Yeah, the Gantian symmetry, maybe let's just pick a little piece of that, dual conformal symmetry, which is a piece of that. This manifestly breaks dual conformal symmetry, that the pieces get moved around. I mean, the entire planar expression of Yang-Mills still has dual conformal invariants, but the pieces get moved around in such a way that no individual piece has dual conformal symmetry. Okay, then through the duality of color, that gets fed into non-planar, and then double copy. But the problem is the way it gets fed through is pretty obscure. I'm sure there's an echo of this. Right. You know, no question. You're starting from planar Yang-Mills, which has Yangian symmetry. You then have this machine that gives you the non-planar and then gives you gravity. So there's an echo of it. But what exactly that echo is, that we don't understand exactly how it tracks through. Yeah.
I just want to make sure the gradient is finite, yes? B,
yeah.
Q is finite, B is smaller than 4 plus 6 over
L. Yeah.
Is there something you know?
We know it for here, for sure.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, yeah, this formula is correct for, here. And the question is, at L equals 5, is that formula correct, or is this formula correct? This is the, the bottle of wine bet. So this is where wine is being bet. There's two formulas. This would be for L equals 5, so it would be 6 over L plus 4, or it would be, so this would be a 5-leaf bet, or the other possibility is 8 over L plus 4. And which of these, this would be the critical dimension, and we have L equals 5. So the bottle of wines get exchanged depending on which of these two formulas are correct. In ordinary gravity, not very much. Actually, Tristan here, Tristan Denon over there, one loop, 4-point Yang, pure Yang-Mills, which you're probably not so impressed with. But we like supersymmetric theories. They're a lot easier to deal with.
Yeah.
But at least we have one example that works that's non-trivial.
There's no counterexample.
There is no counterexample.
So, there are no questions, I think.